Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. The 8th of April 2024 marked the 120th anniversary of the Anton Cordial, which was marked by a rather effusive speech from President Emmanuel Macron, who we all know is something of an Anglophile. France, on that day, became the first non-Commonwealth country to take part in the changing of the guard outside Buckingham Palace, which is some honour. But how did the Anton Cordial come about? What role did it play in the great conflicts of the 20th century? And what is its legacy? To answer these questions, we have as our guest today, T.G. Otter, Thomas Otter, Professor of Diplomatic History at the University of East Anglia and the author of numerous highly acclaimed books, including The July Crisis, The Foreign Office Mind, and most recently, a terrific biography of Britain's former Foreign Minister, Edward Grey, Statesman of Europe. Welcome, Thomas. Let's start at the very beginning here. How did the Anton Cordial come about?
Well, in a rather indirect way. I mean, I'm not giving away any state secrets when I say that relations between Britain and France have been perhaps more often quarrelsome than cordial over centuries. And you could go back, I don't know, to the Hundred Years' War. You know, this is woven into the fabric of both nations. And often there was a strong sense of national identity that arose out of those conflicts with the other, as it were. The Entente of 1904 is, in the first place, a colonial understanding, and that's very important to understand. It's not an alliance of any kind. It's not a military understanding between two countries for the purposes of joint warfare in Europe, for instance. So it's an understanding, that's all that Entente really means. And it's about tidying up outstanding colonial disputes and imperial disputes that had troubled relations between Britain and France for a good 25 years prior to 1904.
And so what would those be?
Well, it all started in earnest with the occupation of Egypt by Britain in 1882. Now, this was not by design. The British government under William Gladstone really sleepwalked into this military intervention in 1882, largely to protect the Suez Canal. The problem was that the French also had interests in Egypt. Unfortunately, as was often the case in France in the 19th century, the French government collapsed just at the moment when a joint Anglo-French naval expedition was supposed to launch a demonstration off Alexandria. And so the British went in on their own. From then on, you have really poor relations between Paris and London. And the question of Egypt and who should control Egypt was a running sore in Anglo-French relations. And it was a sore that would not heal. And there were occasions after 1882, when the two sides were very close to coming to, well, to blows. There was a standoff over the future of Siam in 1893, and you have British and French warships actually training guns on each other in Bangkok Harbor. You have a standoff in the Sudan in 1898, the Fashoda crisis, which was ultimately about a French attempt to force the British out of Egypt by taking control over the upper reaches of the River Nile. And then in the run-up to 1904, you have a situation where the two sides have been talking about how to improve relations between Britain and France. And to add a layer of complication to all of this, their two respective allies, regional allies, were about to become involved in a war in East Asia. and that's Britain's ally Japan and France's ally Russia. And this helped to accelerate talks about a colonial compromise between Britain and France in 1903-4. So in essence, they wanted to be in a situation where they could say to their allies, look, this is your regional war. We, Britain and France, do not want to be dragged into this conflict. So what is the Entente all about? It's about settling those outstanding complications. This is in part about islands in the Pacific. It is about boundaries in West Africa. So it's very much of its time in a way. But at its core is French recognition that Egypt was essentially British. And in return, the British offered the French diplomatic support for their ambitions to establish control over Morocco, which was technically an independent country, but it was a borderline failed state.
And both of them kept out of Siam, which is modern Thailand.
Indeed, they kept out of it in the end. The French took a little bit of eastern Siam.
And when you mention Morocco, we come to something else, that once the Entente comes into play, it operates in the shadow of a much closer rival, a rival to both of them increasingly, to both France and Britain, which is Germany.
Yeah, that's right. And this was one of the unintended consequences of the Entente. And in fact, there's a profound irony about all of this, because Lord Lansdowne, who negotiated the understanding with France, then turned to the Germans and said, let's have une bonne entente with Germany as well. The problem was there weren't really any major disputes with Germany. There was some minor commercial rivalry in connection with railways in the Ottoman Empire, but that was really the extent of it. Why Germany becomes something of a rival actually has a lot to do with the outcome of that war in East Asia between Japan and Russia. Until 1904-5, you have a situation in Europe which is characterized by a reasonably stable military balance. You have, on the one hand, France and Russia, who are allied since the mid-1890s, and on the other hand, you have a rival military bloc of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy, the Triple Alliance. And they balance each other out. And this also meant for Britain that Britain could stay out of European complications, because there weren't any complications. The two sides were roughly as strong as each other, and so they kept each other in check. But with Russia's defeat in East Asia, you lose automatically the entire Russian navy, which now sits at the bottom of the Korean Straits. Russia's finances are in a complete mess, and the Russian army is really needed to keep down revolutionary uprisings inside Russia. So Russia has ceased to be a fully functioning great power, and the Franco-Russian alliance isn't fully functioning either. So there's an imbalance now in Europe. Germany doesn't have to worry about Russia any longer, and so she can throw her weight about a bit. And this is behind the Moroccan crisis that occurs in 1905-6. So there is a danger now that the Germans, whether for offensive reasons, because they want to expand power, or for defensive reasons, because they want to secure themselves in the West against a revanchist France, that the Germans might make war on France. And this then brings the Anglo-French Entente into play, because, to repeat the point I made earlier, the core of the Entente is that imperial bargain, French recognition of British control over Egypt in return for a British promise of diplomatic support for French ambitions over Morocco. And when the French make the claim on controlling Morocco, the Germans intervene, and it looks as though it might come to a war between France and Germany. And this then calls into question what the British might do. And there's a change of government, but the Conservative government that negotiated the Entente, the Liberal government that succeeded it, essentially pursue the same policy. They back France diplomatically by giving the French assurances so that France doesn't buckle under German pressure, but they don't give the French so much support that the French might provoke the Germans into an act of aggression, which would then lead to war, which is precisely what the British don't want. Peace is cheap, war is expensive and uncertain, so you don't want that. The flip side to that is that the British say to the Germans, there's nothing in the Entente that affects Germany. It is a purely colonial agreement. But if you push matters too far and you go to war with France over Morocco, you can't assume that Britain will remain neutral in this war. So assurance of France and assurances to Germany that Britain has peaceful intentions towards Germany, but that Germany could not assume that Britain would stay out of a war that Germany provoked in Europe, was enough to deter the French from provoking Germany, and it was enough to deter the Germans from embarking on an escalatory policy. And that, in essence, is the policy that the British pursue until 1914.
But we have within this two different threats to France and Britain from Germany, as you stated. It's clearly a land war that France fears. It's already endured within living memory by this time, a land war with Germany, a catastrophic land war with Germany. Britain's fears concern the seas. It's had a kind of hegemony for a considerable time in terms of naval power. The great threat here is German naval power and this huge growth of this increasingly major industrial power. There's been the fear of what was revealed by the Boer War about Britain's military capability. And this leads to some kind of paranoia about Germany that is a different kind of paranoia to that that's felt in France about Germany.
That's true, but the fundamental difficulty for British governments was that it was just really hard to read Germany and German intentions accurately.
And why was that?
Why was that? Because deep down, the Germans had no real strategy. And you see, if Germany really had been hell-bent on establishing a form of continental hegemony by military means, then 1905 would have been the perfect point for Germany to go to war, because that would have been a one-on-one with France. There would have been no risk of Russian intervention at all. And it is the Kaiser who actually said, I do not want to go down in history as the man who broke the peace of Europe. So he ensures that there is a more or less peaceful outcome of this crisis. You see, the fundamental problem in all of this is that no one expected Russia to be so weak after 1905. The Germans started building up their navy in the expectation that Britain was locked into a deep, a binding and insurmountable antagonism with both France and Russia, with France over colonial disputes, with Russia over mastery over Asia. And if the Germans, who already had a powerful army, also acquired a powerful navy, then they could force Britain to pay a high political price for Germany's political support against France and Russia. So that was the basic game plan of the naval buildup from the late 1890s onwards. The British built powerful warships, you know, the Dreadnought, for instance, which were actually, this was a type of battleship that was built against the Franco-Russian combination. And then after 1905, you don't have the Russian Navy any longer to take into consideration. The whole two-power standard, which was the yardstick by which the British decided how strong their Navy had to be, was predicated on the strength of the French and Russian navies. So no Russian navy, so you take the German navy into account. And the type of battleship that the Dreadnought was actually not particularly useful for fighting in the North Sea, because it's a fast ship, it has long-range gunnery, so it's not really suited for fighting in the North Sea. So there are all sorts of ironies about all of this. And the Germans had also discovered that if they build a powerful battle fleet, they guarantee full order books for their industry. So there's a sort of powerful naval industrial complex that emerges. But full order books keep the industrialists happy. Full order books also mean that there is full employment. And so the workers will be happy and they won't vote for socialists and won't organize themselves in the trade unions. So there's a powerful domestic consideration for the German government to persist with this naval program. And so the British and the Germans are locked into this arms race, and neither side really understands what the other wants. Again, the irony is that by 1912, the arms race, 1912, 1913, the arms race at sea is practically over, and the Germans have lost it. Because by then, Russia has recovered from the war in Asia and is about to embark on a major armament program, which would see the significant expansion of the Russian army on the borders of Germany. And the Germans realize at that point that they can't really build up a powerful army against France and Russia on land and a powerful navy against Britain at sea. So by 1913-14, you actually see a rapprochement between Germany and Britain and some tensions between Britain and Russia, and there's a coolness that sets in Franco-British relations as well. So things actually are not quite what they appear to be in 1914. If anyone had predicted a war, it was by no means understood that this would mean Britain joining a continental war against Germany.
And France is very aware of this, isn't it? We have Paul Cambon, the French ambassador to London, who pushes again and again for something like a moral commitment, something much more than what the Entente Cordiale actually is, prompted by the Premier Poincaré. It seems to me an incredibly asymmetrical agreement, if that's what it is, an understanding, as you say, to be more accurate. What was in it for Britain? Is it an afterthought for Britain? Is it much more important, the Entente Cordiale, to France than it is to Britain?
Well, there is an asymmetry in that understanding, which is rooted in the different motivations of the two sides. For the British, the intention is to tidy up outstanding colonial disputes. And the assumption simply was that one's relations with France were improved because we now have a settlement that we can both live with. It was less likely that Britain and France would be dragged into complications with Russia or surrounding Russian ambitions in Asia. For the French, the Entente was second best to an alliance, but there was always that understanding in France that it might be a first step that would ultimately lead to an alliance. And so there is an attempt by the French to reel the British in, as it were, to persuade them that really they have committed themselves to, in a moral kind of sense, that there is an implicit understanding that Britain can't afford to lose France as a great power in Europe. And of course, that's what the British understand as well. There can be no balance of power in Europe and therefore stability in Europe if there is no strong France. The question for the British always is, what happens if we were to enter into a binding commitment towards France? Is there not the danger that the French would be emboldened to provoke Germany into an act of aggression secure in the knowledge that Britain would have to come in. So from a British perspective, it seemed better to leave the French in this kind of sense of uncertainty as to what precisely London would do if and when warlike complications, you know, hove into view in Europe.
And of course they do hove into view in the summer of 1914.
That's right. And here, in a sense, you then see the limits of that policy, because whilst we can all talk about the intentions of Austria and Germany, I think it's quite clear that there's only one power in Europe in 1914 that wants war, and that is Austria. There's another power that is sort of willing to allow this war to happen, that is Germany. But equally, Russia is not prepared to back down, having had to back down in previous Balkan crises in 1908-9 and in 1912-13. The Russians would not want to do this again now. And the French are not prepared to rein in the Russians either. And the French president, Poincaré, is convinced that you can only deter Germany from embarking on an aggressive foreign policy by taking a very firm line and threatening war. And this then is something that the British can't overcome. They can't assure the Germans that nothing evil is intended against them. They can't moderate the French, and they can't persuade the French to moderate the Russians. And this becomes clear at some point late in July 1914, and at that point, the mediation efforts that the British have tried simply come to an end.
And so this policy of constructive ambiguity, as I think Grey calls it, is lifting tatters.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And so we talk, or you talk rather, about the political classes here. We've talked about the French and political classes and their differing ideas about the Entente. How was it viewed in Britain by the public? I mean, we have France, you've already outlined, this centuries-old antipathy, rivalry between Britain and France, particularly, one might say, England and France. But certainly there has been widespread public mistrust, even dislike of Russia as some kind of Eastern despot, some Asiatic tyranny, as it was often described. How was it sold, or was it just ignored, those popular ideas? And how did the population view that choice, if choice it could be, between, say, France and Germany?
I mean, one of the problems, of course, we have is that we don't have opinion polls or mass observation that we have for the 1930s and then the period of the Second World War. So it's difficult to gauge popular opinion with any degree of exactitude. And I would suggest probably that most people were just simply not bothered. Foreign countries only mattered when an international crisis hove into view. That's when you could mobilize old stereotypes of, you know, the Russian bear, the Oriental despot, that kind of thing. And you have similar negative stereotypes about France as well, you know, as a revolutionary power, as conversely, as a sort of high-bound clerical Catholic power. And so all of these stereotypes are there, and they don't disappear. It's really only during the First World War that then all of a sudden France is seen as a gallant ally, a fellow Western, well, I hesitate to say democracy. France undoubtedly is a democracy. Britain, of course, is a parliamentary monarchy and not a fully fledged democracy, but it's a sort of Western liberal model. So there are ideological similarities, political similarities, Western civilization versus German Kultur. And all of these things are then played up during the First World War.
And manufactured to a certain extent.
To an extent, manufactured, absolutely. Propaganda is very important to maintain morale.
And we know what happens in 1914. After the Great War, what's the nature of the Entente Cordiale then, the relationship with France?
It's, in a sense, it almost reverts to type. The big issue for France after 1914 1819 is security against Germany. So that hasn't changed.
Yep.
The big issue for Britain is to ensure the economic recovery of Europe. And for that, you need to have a reasonably strong and reasonably prosperous Germany. So you can already see that there is a mutual incompatibility between French and British ambitions built into the system. The French want to have a British security guarantee, and the British will absolutely not give that security guarantee because they think that is the mistake that then led to 1914.
So this ambiguity persists in that sense, or at least it's reclaimed, I suppose.
Exactly, exactly. And there's imperial rivalry in the Middle East as well and elsewhere. And the British are not happy about the French occupation of the Ruhr in 1923-24, for instance. So there's always a struggle about how to ensure a viable European security system. And that's almost secured at Locarno in 1925, when Britain and Italy guarantee the new frontiers in Western Europe, which are also recognized by Germany. Germany's admitted to the League of Nations, and all of a sudden you have almost a new concert of Europe, where Germany is admitted to the kind of club of the five key powers in Europe that really set the agenda. And the German foreign minister, Stresemann, the French foreign minister, Aristide Briand, and Austen Chamberlain, the British foreign secretary, they come together at Geneva on the fringes of the League of Nations assembly meetings for what were sometimes called Geneva Tea Parties. But they really discuss about common interests and what they can do to improve international politics. Unfortunately, by 1929, one of them is dead, one is out of office, the other is about to leave office. And of course, Europe is hit by the global economic crisis. And then things just go wrong from then on.
And how does that, when we get the Great Depression, when, of course, ultimately we have Hitler coming to power in Germany, how does that affect the Entente?
Well, it's the same problem. It is about security. And British governments don't want to give the French a security guarantee. There is also an assumption that maybe Germany was treated harshly in 1919 and that some concessions could be made to Germany to allow Germany to feel secure in a new Europe. And in a sense, if you wanted to justify appeasement, that's basically what the whole appeasement strategy is about. And of course, at Munich, what Neville Chamberlain, Austen's half-brother, gets is a German guarantee of the new frontiers in the new Czech frontiers after the Germans have taken the Sudeten areas. Of course, Hitler had no intention of keeping his promises, but that would be the argument in favor of an appeasement strategy. But fundamentally, the British were reluctant to give any kind of security guarantees.
And presumably, when war does break out, when Germany invades France in 1940, Britain is led by then by a famously Francophile Prime Minister in Winston Churchill. Does he use the Entente in a propagandist way?
I couldn't think of an example off the top of my head. But of course, the example is always there in the background. It's quite telling also that just before France was about to surrender, Churchill proposed the political union of the two states.
Yeah, yeah.
So with joint citizenship and a joint government. Now, this is then rejected by the French, and we can have a long debate about whether or not Churchill was serious about it, or whether he just wanted to have control over the French Navy. All of these were strategic calculations that were clearly somewhere in the back of his mind. But relations with France, of course, were complicated. You have, on the one hand, after the surrender, Vichy France, which is a sort of return to the rather more reactionary, clerical type of France that occasionally we have seen in the 19th century. relations with de Gaulle as the leader of the Free French are notoriously prickly.
Yep.
And we have these occasions when the two are locked in the cabinet room in Downing Street and they're shouting at each other. And then all of a sudden there's silence and Churchill's secretaries are alarmed because they actually think that de Gaulle has killed Churchill or they have killed each other. Only then to discover later that they're just smoking a cigar because they're so exhausted from all that shouting. So the relationship is difficult underneath the superficially cordial surface. And that relationship, in a sense, carries on into the post-war years. And it carries on really until today. So there always is that element of slight mistrust, whether it's de Gaulle's famous no when Macmillan tried to get into Europe or Harold Wilson tried to get into Europe, or whether it's on our side, mistrust when she wanted to become prime minister. Somebody incautiously suggested that the jury was still out as to whether President Macron was a friend or a foe of this country. So that element of mistrust has never entirely disappeared.
Well, on the 120th anniversary of the Entente Cordiale, President Macron presented a rather generous speech. What do you think he was up to with that speech? I mean, he does seem, just as Churchill was a great Francophile, there is something of the Anglophile about Macron. He speaks English well. He knows Britain. What do you think was behind the speech that he gave and that was widely publicised?
I can't claim to have any superior insights into the inner workings of Emmanuel Macron's mind. If you speak to any ambassador, current or former, who ever served at Paris, you will know that the British Embassy has a file already ready with a speech for the ambassador in which he says positive things about the Entente. And I'm sure the French president has a similar file ready for him to bring out on these occasions. But we are in a rather more volatile international situation where the environment is altogether more hostile. And France and Britain are two countries that are the only nuclear-armed states in Europe, with the exception of Russia, of course. If Russia is a European state, and we can have a debate about that. They are of similar size. Their economies are roughly similar, and the two countries have a similar global strategic outlook and tradition. So it does make sense to build on the existing defense and security cooperation between the two countries, and that is quite clearly important at the moment. I think it's also worth noting that the French in particular, but also the Germans, have moved on from Brexit. I think feelings were quite raw on the other side of the channel after 2016. But I think we have moved on from that. And there is a clear understanding that it is in the interest of the Europeans, it is in the interest of this country to have a new constructive relationship with each other that is built on trade, of course, but also that looks towards defense and security at a time when you have a hostile Russia and at a time when American support for European security can simply not be assumed as guaranteed as it had been for the past 75 years. And at a time also when relations with China are, shall we say, more fraught than they have been or had been in the kind of 10, 15, 20 years prior to 2015 or 2014.
And so this is a relatively positive moment in the 120-year history of this ambiguous, elusive, one would say elusive, Entente.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, if I may say so, there is a narrow path to be steered between perhaps French and possibly European preferences for a very firm institutional setup within which this new evolving relationship with Britain might evolve further. And the British preference for looser, more nimble, perhaps ad hoc arrangements. I think if the history of the 20th century has taught us anything, it is that those loose alliances tend to be fragile, and if they are not nurtured and maintained and worked at continuously, they may simply atrophy. At the same time, complex institutional arrangements often become too cumbersome, and the governments involved or the parties involved may get involved in processology, which doesn't necessarily produce good outcomes. So I think we need to steer a pragmatic course between those two preferences.
So ambiguous, but also enduring. Well, thank you, Thomas, for that very lucid survey of 120 years of the Entente Cordiale.
Thank you.
That was T.G. Otter and Paul Lay. You've been listening to EI Talks. EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Until next time, thanks for listening.